We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for April 11th, 2023. Today we welcome Lorraine Fernand, the immediate past president of the International Health Information Association. Lorraine joins us as we conclude a two-part series on World Health Day. We'll get coding news from Lori Johnson. Stanley Nachimson has the latest regulatory news coming out of Washington. Tiffany Ferguson covers the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday news desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her Talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and another man who mistakenly wandered into IKEA and couldn't find his way out, Chuck Buck.
Great, Clark. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Talk 10 Tuesday, and good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
As you heard Clark Anthony announce, we're going to conclude our two-part series this morning on the World Health Day. What do you think about that? Actually, the World Health Day was last Friday, April the 7th.
Yeah, I know. And we also forgot to wish you all a Chag Pesach Sameach and a Happy Easter. So sorry about that.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, thank you. And coming up, what are you going to be talking about today during your talkback segment?
I'm going to be talking about a recent OIG report and the use of the phrase history of.
History of. Very good. Excellent topic. And as always, Erica, we look forward to your topic. And now's the time for the Talk 10 Tuesday news report. So we're going out to Tim Powell. He's at the Talk 10 Tuesday news desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And today, I want to talk about the Medicare Advantage final rule that just came out. The final rule issued this week by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, will ensure that Medicare Advantage plans work for seniors and people with disabilities by cracking down on misleading marketing schemes and removing barriers to care, expanding access to behavioral health care, and promoting health equity. This new rule will strengthen Medicare Advantage and hold health care insurance companies to higher standards. Moreover, implementing a key provision of the Inflation Reduction Act will improve access to affordable prescription drugs for an estimated 300,000 low-income individuals. This is a significant step towards improving healthcare for all Americans, especially those that are vulnerable. And under the new rule, advertisements for Medicare Advantage and Part D plans must mention a specific plan name and must not use the Medicare name, CMS logo, or any other information issued by the federal government in a misleading way. The rule also increases the accountability for plans to monitor the activities of agents who broker and sell Medicare Advantage plans. Overall, the changes outlined in the final rule aim to improve transparency and accountability in the marketing of Medicare Advantage and Part D plans, which could help individuals to make more informed decisions about their healthcare coverage. And also under the new rule, a granted prior authorization approval must remain valid for as long as it is medically necessary to avoid disruption in care. Medicare Advantage plans will also be required to conduct annual reviews of their utilization management policies to ensure that they are up to date and effective. And in addition, healthcare professionals with relevant expertise must review denials of coverage based on medical necessity before a denial can be issued. These changes are intended to complement proposals in CMS's Advancing Interoperability and Improving Prior Authorization Process proposed rule under CMS 0057-P, which seeks to improve the electronic exchange of health information and streamline the prior authorization process through greater standardization and automation. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It's Tuesday. It's April 11th, and you're listening to the live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
Are you struggling with the correct use of modifiers in your medical coding and billing practices? Are you unsure about the compliance requirements for modifier usage or whether your modifiers are conveying the right information to payers? If so, this on-demand webcast is a must-attend event for you. Learn how to use modifiers effectively to prevent claim denials while ensuring proper reimbursement. Learn about the most utilized modifiers as well as what modifiers can affect reimbursement. Register now to attend this important webcast and gain knowledge and skills to validate documentation. Don't let modifier mayhem lead to claim denials or improper reimbursement. Take the first step toward preventing claim denials and ensuring proper reimbursement. Register for Mastering Modifier Usage, Preventing Denials, and Ensuring Compliance, now available on demand.
Now's the time for the Talk to Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. Today, I want to highlight some portions of the change request, or CR13136, which became effective April 1st, 2023, and it was implemented on April 3rd, 2023. This change request is titled Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System April 2023 Update. First, there's some new COVID-19 CPT codes, and they are 91316 for the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine bivalent. It's a booster for ages 6 months through 5 years. And the administration for that vaccine is 0164A. The next vaccine code is 91317, which is Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19 bivalent. And the administration code is 0173A. These codes will be assigned status indicator of L, which means they're not paid under OPPS, but they're paid at a reasonable cost, which is not subject to deductible or coinsurance. The second topic is after the public health emergency, which is May 11th, treatments for COVID will be paid under comprehensive APC on an outpatient claim. There are 23 new proprietary laboratory analyses, or PLA, codes from 0364U through 0386U, which also became effective April 1st. You can see Addendum B for the short descriptors and the status indicators. There are three new devices that have been added to the pass-through status, and they are C1747 endoscope single use for urinary tract, and the offset is $507.69. C1826, which is a generator neurostimulator implantable, and it includes the closed feedback loop leads with a rechargeable battery, and the offset is $24,024.04. C1827, which is a generator neurostimulator implantable, non-rechargeable with implantable lead and external paired stimulation controller, and the offset is $24,024.02. Another topic is there is an expired pass-through status, which became effective January 1st, 2023, and that is for code C1823, which is generator neurostimulator implantable, non-rechargeable with transvenous sensing and stimulation leads. There was also an error in the October 2022 release, and C1834, which is a pressure sensor system, includes all components, for example, introducer and sensor. It's intramuscular, implantable, and excludes mobile wireless software application, was approved in error, and the code will be removed effective March 31st, 2023. So that's already happened. There are 12 new drugs, biologicals, and radiopharmaceuticals, which were effective April 1st, 2023. And you can see table 5 in the CR13136 for all of the details. There are two drugs that are biologicals and radiopharmaceuticals that had a status indicator change effective April 1st. And table 6 in that document will also be listed. And one last item is that one drug, J1411, which is injection of etranacogene dezaparvovec drib per therapeutic dose, will require manual adjudication. The payment will be based on average sales price, or ASP. The payment rate for APC 9138 is initially listed as $0. And that is to trigger or prompt the user to get the payment for that drug. So the change request contains a huge amount of information, especially for the charge master, coordinator, or any claim auditors. I have always found that the quarterly updates were very important. So that gives you your work for this week. And with that, Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. I do not envy you having to pronounce those drug names. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thank you, Erica. And Lori Johnson, thank you very, very much. Here now with the Talk to Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is Tiffany Ferguson. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, all. So with the expectation that the public health emergency will be ending, I'm going to expand for our Talk 10 Tuesday folks the topic that Dr. Juliette Ugarte-Hopkins discussed last Monday on Monitor Monday. I encourage everyone to tune into the recording of the broadcast and see her article that'll be coming out later this week regarding the history and Medicare rules of the three-day stay. The three-day stay for Medicare patients is the requirement that based on the time of the order of inpatient, the patient must pass 3 midnights of continued inpatient hospital care in order to qualify for skilled nursing placement. The reminder of this rule is important for many case managers as we have had a break for the last 2 years from counting midnights. This will be one more thing that the case managers will need to make sure they are tracking when it comes to the time to transfer qualifying Medicare patients to skilled nursing facilities. The three-day rule for inpatient stay specifically applies to traditional Medicare patients. Patients that have a Medicare Advantage plan have specifications. Make sure that you're checking the specifications in their contract, in your contract or the provider manual that may allow the transfer of patients to skilled placement, regardless of the three-day stay or even the requirement for inpatient admission. Case managers will want to check their hospital contracts, verify this, that during the skilled nursing authorization period, if the contracted payer will once again make this a requirement. I would expect that the hospital case management team be up to date on this expectation, as you cannot rely on the skilled nursing facilities to necessarily know the exact date and time of the inpatient order. There are some additional specifications to the rule that's important to remember. One of those is the 30-day period. The 30-day period states that if the patient has a break in skilled care that lasts more than 30 days, they will need a new 3-day hospital stay to qualify for the additional SNF care. The new hospital stay does not need to be for the same condition that they are treated for during the previous stay. For patients that do not have a 30-day break in skilled care, then the 3-day stay rule does not apply. So, for example, a patient was inpatient on an index admission for 4 inpatient hospital days. The patient was recommended for SNF placement, but elected instead to go home with home health instead. The patient went home for 2 days and then realized this was maybe a terrible idea and returned to the hospital. The patient was readmitted as outpatient, or maybe they were in the ED, depending on what was going on. They could be going directly to skilled placement again under the original index admission because they were still within that 30-day period. They would not have to be readmitted under inpatient if there wasn't medical necessity. I will include more details regarding the 60-day stay for utilization and what that qualifies for SNF placement around the 3-day rule and expand on Dr. Ugarte's article in my upcoming article this week. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Tiffany. I am living through this myself. My father just got transferred to a skilled nursing facility last night after a 5-day stay in the hospital. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is CEO for Phoenix Medical Management.
Now's the time for Reg Watch featuring nationally recognized healthcare technology consultant Stanley Knockerson. Good morning, Stanley. Stanley, CMS has been really busy lately. I mean, 4 proposed rules last week, and then there is a final rule. And then yesterday, CMS released the 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System proposed rules. So, Stanley, what do we really need to know?
Good morning, Chuck, and to everybody on the broadcast. Yes, Chuck, 'tis the season for proposed and final rules from CMS. After a brief pause during the winter months, CMS is again issuing a number of these rules for payment policies for fiscal year 2024. Both fee-for-service Medicare and Medicare Advantage changes are being proposed. CMS published the 2024 Medicare Advantage or Part C rate announcement on March 31st. The key item for our listeners here is the revised Medicare Advantage risk adjustment model. It includes important technical updates, including restructured condition categories using the ICD-10 classification system instead of the ICD-9 classification system, and updated underlying fee-for-service data years from 2014 and 2015 to 2018 and 2019, as well as revisions focused on conditions that are subject to more coding variations. This new model will be phased in over 3 years. Details of the revisions are included in the rate announcement. In the 2024 Medicare Advantage and Part D final rule, CMS clarified clinical criteria guidelines to ensure people with Medicare Advantage receive access to the same medically necessary care they would receive in traditional Medicare by requiring the MA plans comply with national coverage determinations, local coverage determinations, and general coverage and benefit conditions included in traditional Medicare regulations. CMS is also finalizing that when coverage criteria are not fully established, MA organizations may create internal coverage criteria based on current evidence in widely used treatment guidelines or clinical literature made publicly available to CMS, its enrollees, and providers. The final rule also streamlines prior authorization requirements, requires that coordinated care plan prior authorization policies may only be used to confirm the presence of diagnoses or other medical criteria and or ensure that an item or service is medically necessary and that plans provide a minimum 90-day transition period when an enrollee currently undergoes treatment switches and goes to a new MA plan. During that time, the new MA plan may not require prior authorization for the active course of treatment. And we're now in the season for the proposed fiscal year 2024 Medicare fee-for-service payment and policy rules for institutional provider types. So far, CMS has published the fiscal year 2024 skilled nursing facility prospective payment system proposed rule, resulting in a net increase of 3.7% in Medicare Part A payments to SNFs. CMS is also proposing several changes to the ICD-10 code mappings for the SNF case mix classification known as PDPM. Those proposed changes to the mapping and lists are available on the PDPM website. CMS is also proposing the adoption of 4 new quality measures, the replacement of 1 quality measure, and several policy changes in the value-based purchasing program. Inpatient Psychiatric Facility Prospective Payment System Rule for fiscal year 2024 was also just published. It updates the payment rates and includes a proposal to modify regulations to allow hospitals to open and begin Medicare for an excluded IPF unit anytime within the cost reporting year, which CMS believes will help increase access to essential inpatient psychiatric services and available beds. And the fiscal year 2024 inpatient rehab facility prospective payment system proposed rule proposes to update the PPS payment rates by 3%. This proposed rule also proposes to allow hospitals to also open a new inpatient rehab facility unit and begin being paid under the IRF PPS at any time during the cost reporting period with certain reporting conditions. And as been mentioned, the new 2024 inpatient hospital PPS and long-term care hospital PPS rule was just published yesterday. Besides some small changes to the payment rates, it includes 2 important items regarding social determinants of health. It requires that hospitals use homelessness and record that as a complicating condition, and also includes several quality measures for the social determinants of health. Continues CMS's emphasis on using social determinants of health to affect Medicare payments and provide greater access to Medicare. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Stanley. That was Healthcare IT Authority Stanley Nachimson. Stanley is the founder of Nachimson Advisors, LLC. Chuck?
Thank you, Erica. And thank you again, Stanley Dockerson, very much. If you're listening to Talk 10 Tuesday, stand by.
Are your doctors flailing and failing because they cannot document correctly? Are your patients and revenue at risk? Too often, poor physician documentation leads to a cascade of negative consequences, regrettable patient outcomes, pesky readmissions, and terrible public quality reporting. But here's good news. You can improve provider documentation with a set of remarkable learning modules complete with CME. Introducing Dr. Reamer's documentation modules, concise and easy to learn information, so your providers can improve their clinical documentation on demand. Dr. Reamer's documentation modules will inspire your physicians to document their patients to look as sick and complex as they actually are. Clinical documentation specialists and physician advisors love them too. Order Dr. Reamer's documentation modules for your providers now and start seeing clinical documentation improvement today.
Coming up next, our lead story.
The Talk 10 Tuesday lead story is sponsored by the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Clinic Update webcast series. Get access to important guidance on each of the AHA's 2023 ICD-10 CMPCS quarterly coding clinics, with information-packed on-demand webcasts available shortly after each official publication.
Today, we conclude our two-part series that recognizes World Healthcare Day, sponsored by the World Health Organization. And now for an update on the World Health Organization and its activities, here is Lorraine Fernand. Lorraine is the immediate past president of the International Federation of Information Management Association. Good morning, Lorraine. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Chuck, for the invitation to return to help us celebrate World Health Day. So World Health Day, as you already heard, was celebrated last Friday, April 7th. But it's also the 75th anniversary of the World Health Organization, so I anticipate lots of festivities for the year. IFHEMA proudly maintains a 40-plus year relationship with WHO as an NGO, the only health information one in the world, confirmed by our common objectives, well articulated in our vision, a healthy world enabled by quality health information. So over the past 3 years of my term as president, we've accomplished much, but the journey has a lot to continue to work on. So visit our website at IFHEMA.org related to our work with WHO, including the September 29th virtual ICD-11 webcast. Particularly noteworthy are the podcasts we've created from Miroslav Zavalsky in the Czech Republic, Megan Cumerlato from Australia, and Akila Jamal from Canada. IFHEMA also has members serving on the WHOFIC, that's the family of international classifications, their committees and work groups, including Mary Stanfill, who you hear from frequently, and Kathy Gianangelo from the US, Sharon Baker from Canada, Vicky Bennett from Australia, Dr. Islam Ibrahim from Kuwait, and many others from IFHEMA who work in various capacities with the WHO. I'm delighted to say that Dr. Kidong Park, who is the Director of Data Strategy and Innovation at the WHO offices in the Western Pacific, will be a keynote speaker at our 20th Congress in Brisbane. So IFHEMA celebrates its growing international membership with 33 nations now represented across all of our membership categories. We've added Bangladesh, Bermuda, Ireland, Malaysia, South Africa, and the United Arab Emirates just in 2023 to our membership categories. World Health Day is a great opportunity to announce the publication of our article, Gaining an International Perspective on Health Information Management, in the Journal of IHEMA. Obviously, we thank IHEMA for featuring this article. And of course, it begins to celebrate the 29th of October, 20th IFHEMA Congress in Brisbane. The article also celebrates Margaret Skirka, well known to many on this broadcast, as the inaugural IFEMA Tribute to Excellence awardee. We hope you'll be enticed to join us in Brisbane as we continue to expand the knowledge and the commitment to global health that I believe we all share. So check out the early registration materials, which provide a substantial discount to coming to Brisbane in our Congress if you're a member of IFEMA or HIMA, the Australian Association. So I hope you'll join us again, as I said, in Brisbane for the Congress starting the 29th of October, where we'll raise a glass together, and perhaps two or three even, in celebrating our ongoing commitment consistent with World Health Day, a healthy world enabled by quality health information. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Lorraine. I wish I could come. That was the immediate past president of the International Health Information Association, Lorraine Fernandes. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, very much. And thank you, Lorraine. Nice to have you on our program and welcome back. Now's the time for a very popular segment here at Dr. Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
First, a clarification from last week. One of our listeners wrote in that they had contact with Coding Clinic and that Z12.1- encounter for screening for malignant neoplasm of whatever bowel part it is should be sequenced first, and then R19.5 other fecal abnormalities would be a secondary diagnosis. And this does seem reasonable to me. So now I'm going to do my talk back. Dr. Ronald Hirsch suggested that I address a recent Office of Inspector General report, which came out in mid-March, called Medicare Advantage Compliance Audit of Specific Diagnosis Codes that Geisinger Health Plan submitted to CMS. The issue is that there has been scrutiny of Medicare Advantage plans with which the OIG feels may be achieving higher risk adjustment scores than they are entitled to. Here is my take. The verbiage, history of, means something different to a coder than it does to a clinician. Clinicians are often indicating that the patient's medical history includes the condition, and they are not trying to convey whether the disease process is currently present or historical. However, as we know, history of to a coder signifies that the condition is resolved, old, no longer actively being treated. It leads to a set of personal history codes in Z85 to 87. Clinicians are not coders, but they are often asked to select ICD-10 CM codes. If they type in a condition, the acute version often pops up ahead of the personal history of version, and they accidentally select the wrong code and move on to the next patient. There were 9 target diagnoses which were listed, and please see my ICD-10 monitor article that will be coming out for a more extensive review on this topic. The OIG has visited acute stroke before. The problem is that a patient only has an acute stroke for a short period of time, usually eliciting a hospitalization. When they follow up, they no longer have a stroke. They either have neurologic deficits from the previous stroke, which use sequela codes, or they have a history of stroke without sequelae, and that's Z86.73 or 79. I recommend telling the provider that if they have the urge, that if they do not have the urge to call 911 from their office, then they shouldn't be using an acute stroke code. Interestingly, paralytic syndromes as sequelae from strokes have a higher HCC risk adjustment than even an acute stroke. History of stroke has no risk adjustment implications. Myocardial infarction is a little different. As long as it is a legitimate other diagnosis that is being monitored, evaluated, assessed, or treated, an acute MI code is captured for 4 weeks following the acute presentation. After 4 weeks, it is downgraded to I25.2, old myocardial infarction. The latter has no risk adjustment. This is an opportunity to explicitly detail how the condition is being MEAT meted so as to leave no doubt with the auditor. Embolism would best be managed with the provider documenting acute, chronic, or history of if a clot is no longer present. There are Z86.7 codes for personal history of pulmonary embolism and of other venous thrombosis and embolism. If a provider carelessly just slaps a DVT diagnosis on when it should be a history of DVT code, They are claiming risk adjustment when it is not warranted. There were other conditions which the auditor is specifically looking for evidence of active treatment, but I want to focus on malignancy diagnoses. The criterion that the OIG used to judge whether it was a clinically valid diagnosis during this service year or not was whether there had been surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy administered within a six-month period before or after the diagnosis. I could think of exceptions to the rule. Immunotherapy wasn't on the list. And what if the patient declined treatment? What if through shared decision-making, the patient was going to undergo watchful waiting for their prostate cancer? The ICD-10-CM coding guidelines advise using a history of cancer Z85 code if, quote, a primary malignancy has been previously excised or eradicated from its site, and there is no further treatment directed to that site, and there is no evidence of an existing primary malignancy at that site, close quote. Best practice is for providers to use their clinical judgment and clearly spell out how they are meeting the diagnosis. If they are choosing codes, it might be prudent for a coder to review them pre-submission and teach providers what constitutes history of. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of fighting denials and the OIG. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. Excellent topic. And that is going to be a wrap for our 549th live edition of Dr. Tuesday. I want to thank our panelists today, Tiffany Ferguson, Lori Johnson, Tim Powell, Lorraine Fernand, who reported our lead story, and a very special thanks to my co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And remember, folks, when you can't listen to us live, you can listen to all the Tucked In Tuesday podcasts on Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, and when you do, rate us. Give us a review. Until next week, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for Tucked In Tuesday and ICD-10 Monitor. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great week.
Tucked In Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.